Today, the Everything Bubble. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to this post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Well, yesterday I participated in an online forum with speakers including Harry Dent and Robert Kiyosaki. And essentially the thesis was that we're bubbling up to a very uncertain time in financial markets. Everything is bubbling, everything is high, and the risks are extending. But of course, the really interesting discussion is, so what do you do about it? How do you think about it? Well, I had a chance to share my thoughts in that seminar, and this is a bit of a replay of that conversation with some added detail and later data. And I should just caveat this, of course, as I always do, to say that this is not in any way financial advice. It's simply a reflection of things that I see and questions that I ask. So let's get started. And to do that, let me just talk a little bit about what I'm going to talk about. And it's going to be based around what you already know, what you're told, and also perhaps what you should know. And again, this is not in any way financial advice. Now, a good place to start is just to look at the recent market movements. Of course, over the last few days, the Dow Jones has been up and down like a yo-yo. It was significantly down on Monday. It recovered on Tuesday. And we are seeing what is commonly known as a megaphone pattern. It's going higher and higher and then drops back and goes higher again and drops back. That, of course, is a sign of toppiness and a sign of extremes. You can also argue that gold has gone pretty well nowhere for quite some time. It's just sitting around 1,800 US. Of course, very little real inflation here and very little inflation protection, frankly. And then if you look at Bitcoin, well, Bitcoin's dropped below that $30,000 level US, of course, we're talking about there. It's sitting around 29,700. And after so many expectations of considerable rises, it's come back. Of course, it may go higher again. Those three indices are simply examples of what I'm talking about here. We've got to the point where the markets are very unstable. They're going higher, coming back, going higher, coming back. And a lot of it is, of course, to do with the very large degree of quantitative easing that's been going on for a long, long time. Of course, it started around the global financial crisis or before, but recently it's gone through the roof. And more liquidity is being thrown into the system by central banks around the world. And of course, the question is, what happens next? Well, it's quite a good question to ask, quite a hard question to answer. But that said, I'll give you an example in Australia where we've got essentially nothing much happening other than lending for housing. So the quantitative easing strategy in Australia has been very strongly get interest rates down, and also lend more. So if you look at the owner-occupation lending, it's now growing at 6.56% over the last year. Overall housing lending is at 4.78%, and investment lending is at 1.63% annualized over 12 months. So this is all about stoking credit for housing. And that's one of the reasons why property prices in Australia have been running so hard and fast in recent times. Of course, the lockdowns may change that, but that's where we are now. It's also worth noting that personal credit, after a significant drop, is growing. Well, no, it's not. That's just the rate of growth, or it's just the rate of shrinkage is slowing. So it's still in negative territory. People are not necessarily borrowing formal credit, but what, of course, they are doing is using buy now, pay later and other more informal routes of credit. Business lending, unfortunately, is also down about 2% annualized. And that's a real big concern, because what this is suggesting is that the quantitative easing, in other words, the money printing that's going on, is not going into the real economy. It's not actually driving productive investment. It's going into housing, if at all, or actually quite a lot of it's just going back to the central bank through things like the term funding scheme. You know, the term funding scheme was something which the banks had access to, $200 billion of very cheap money from the Reserve Bank. Well, they've actually lodged more than that, way more than that, back at the central bank. In other words, all that money has just flown around the circle and gone back because they can't lend it. And that suggests to me that credit growth is not necessarily correlated with real investment in the real economy at all. Credit growth is just frankly stoking house prices more. And just to underscore that, here is a chart that shows you the difference between the term funding facility sitting at 187.7 according to the Reserve Bank numbers. That's the amount the Reserve Bank has thrown at the banks. Whereas the banks have got $328 billion sitting with the RBA. In other words, they've got more money sitting at the RBA than the RBA gave them. And whilst it has driven interest rates down, it's not actually necessarily creating significant liquidity in the marketplace. And that's a bit of a similar to the story with reverse repos in the US, where again, what we're finding is that banks in the US are parking more and more money at the Fed on overnight repurchase agreements because they can't find anywhere else to lend it. So this is another example where the quantitative easing programs have got to the point where it's not flowing into the real economy. That is a big problem. Now, the Bank for International Settlements warned the other day that there was a very big concern about the rapid house prices around the world, including in Australia. It poses serious challenges to the recovery. And the Bank for International Settlements, of course, is relevant because it's the banker's central banker, as it were. And a lot of central banks will be taking note of what the BIS is saying. And they went on to say that judging that some central banks may have little choice but to tighten, the BIS warned, that postponing normalisation beyond a certain point may actually harm the economy. In other words, if you keep rates too low for too long, which is precisely where we are with the Reserve Bank, it could definitely create a problem. And they went on to say keeping monetary policy accommodative to support fiscal consolidation could encourage a further build-up in financial imbalances in the private sector, the BIS said. Very important warning there. And they also finally said, given the exceptionally low service burdens, it could also induce further increases in government debt. In both cases, the economy's sensitivity to higher interest rates would rise. Now, that's very relevant because there was a recent House of Lords report came out suggesting that the Bank of England in the UK had been going through quantitative easing programs without explaining how it was going to exit QE. And this House of Lords report basically claimed that the reason the Bank of England was doing what they were doing was to lower government borrowing costs, and that the Bank of England and the Treasury were a bit in cahoots. And frankly, the Bank of England wasn't really being honest and truthful with regard to what was going on. Now, I think that's a very important warning, and I have a feeling that we could argue the same here in Australia. Anyhow, what about oil? Another area of interest, another area of concern. Prices went up quite high and then came back. But what's quite interesting here is that the OPEC Plus basically struggled to work out what to do, but more recently they've announced they're going to actually pump more oil into the system, and oil prices came down a bit. But that's another sign of instability in the financial system at the moment. And there was an interesting quote in this article: at stake is the stability of the global economic recovery amid growing inflationary pressures and the ability of the Producers' Alliance to retain its hard-won control over the oil market. So they're going to try some more to control the market by pumping up oil production. And once again, it shows that, you know, there is more question about what's going on. Now, here's another story which is worth reflecting on. Of course, the RBA held again last month. They basically decided to retain the April 24 bond as the target 10 basis point of yield control. And also, they said that they would reduce their bond purchasing to $4 billion from $5 billion. which essentially suggests that they would own about 30% of government bonds by November and 15% of state bonds. Interestingly, Westpac's come out since then and said, given the issues with the COVID resurgence here in Australia, the Reserve Bank probably should not reduce to 4. They should stay at 5, and that would, of course, suggest that more quantitative easing would follow and that the RBA would then own more government bonds than ever before. But I refer you again to that report from the House of Lords, which basically said, remember, that there is no exit strategy planned for quantitative easing. In fact, no central bank around the world has explained how they're going to reverse it. So it's perpetual printing to the moon. They also maintain the cash rate at 10 basis points. And it's worth reflecting on that. Very, very low rates of interest. One of the reasons why property prices have boomed so much is looser lending standards and also lower interest rates, which means that people can borrow more unless rates go up. But of course, many people don't consider what may happen to rates ahead and don't actually do any sensitivity analysis on what might happen if rates, for example, go up by 1 or 2%, which, by the way, although the Reserve Bank is talking about controlling interest rates out till 2024, there are definitely rising signs around the world from Canada and from, for example, New Zealand. And in fact, New Zealand, the New Zealand Bank there started to indicate a tightening of quantitative easing. And some experts are now suggesting that rates could rise as early as August this year in New Zealand. That would be a big shock to the system if they did that. Now, the Reserve Bank also made the point that they're committed to achieving goals of full employment and inflation. And in a way, what they've done is they've changed the narrative. It always used to be inflation control. Now they're saying we're happy to let inflation run away a little because it's all about employment and getting employment down. I've got concern about that because, you know, it should be possible to do both, not necessarily either or. And if you are prioritising lower levels of unemployment, in other words, more jobs, compared with controlling inflation, that could well let inflation get out of hand. And there's been a lot of worrying conversations around the world quite recently about, is inflation out of the bottle? Now, my own view is that inflation at the moment is still pretty much defined as transitory. In other words, it's short-term changes due to supply chain disruptions and what's called the base effect. When rates drop, they then come back and the percentage uplift is a lot stronger because they're starting from a lower base. So the base effect is real. But there are some signs, I think, beyond that, which suggest that maybe inflation is starting to take hold. And if it does, that's a concern. Of course, it's not measured very well. We know there are lots of categories of spending that is not actually caught in the inflation numbers, including a lot of costs of housing. And we also know that many households from my surveys in real terms are really struggling with the rising costs of things. So in a way, the official inflation number is pretty deceptive when it comes to real life experience of most households in the country. Now, the next thing to talk about with the Reserve Bank was they were saying that the recovery is stronger than earlier expected, but it's also a bit wobbly. And, you know, they talked about the outbreaks. If the outbreaks are contained and restrictions are eased, the economy bounces back quite quickly. Of course, the reverse is also true. And they're talking about the labour market improving. Well, let's see whether that's changing simply because of the fact that the virus is now back up in ascendancy in a number of states in Australia. And it's likely, they said, that the recovery and wages growth is likely to be gradual and modest. They're expecting inflation in underlying terms to be at 1.5% over 2021 and 2% by 2023. And in the short term, CPI is expected to rise temporarily. So they're talking about temporary stuff again. And they're suggesting that they need wages growth of around 3% to really start to lift wages. Well, I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. And they went on to say that maintaining the 10 basis point control on the April 2024 bond will help to keep interest rates low at the short end of the yield curve. And they also made the point that the bond purchasing program is going to be adjusted to take account of what's happening with the economy. If the economy is stronger, they will perhaps tighten it sooner. On the other hand, if the economy is weaker because of the virus coming back, the reverse is probably true. They mentioned, of course, the term funding facilities I mentioned earlier on. That's now completed. The banks have got cheap money, very, very cheap money for 3 years. And the housing market, they said, is continuing to strengthen. But they're talking again about the question of lending standards, important lending standards are maintained. Now, I have to say that I disagree with them at the moment. My evidence in my survey suggests that lending standards have loosened considerably. People are able to get bigger mortgages. Rates are lower, of course, and banks are very keen to lend at the moment. It is the only game in town, as I showed you earlier on from that earlier chart. So really what this means is that lending for housing is definitely going to continue, but the question is how strong will it be and how much will it push house prices up? And they basically said, well, you know, we'll do what we're doing. We think that the rates won't be moving up before 2024. My argument is it almost certainly will be there before 2024. Rates will start moving up. And before the COVID lockdowns, a lot of the banks were actually also taking a similar position and suggesting that rates would rise sooner. This is from CBA, who basically said, yep, expect rates to rise earlier, maybe in November 2022. We've penciled in an increase of 15 basis points, which would take the cash rate to 0.25%. We expect that will be followed by an increase of 25 basis points in December 2022. And we have three further 25 basis point hikes in Q1 23, Q2 23, and Q3 23. And that would suggest that rates would be considerably higher than they currently are today. And that, of course, is a problem for those who've got big mortgages and are on very thin cash flows, as many households are at the moment. And again, I say, many people, when they think about taking out a mortgage, don't run the counterfactual. What happens if rates go up? How will you cope? How will you deal with it? And this is, I think, a very important question now, because at some point rates will rise. It's quite clear. It's just a matter of when. And some other modelling has suggested that the variable rate for mortgages could be over 4.3% as early as 2023, which effectively means a rate of 1.25% in the cash. And that is not that far away. And of course, we are still wrestling with lockdowns and lack of income growth. So many households would find that very, very traumatic. And again, I say, it's worth running sensitivity analysis and being clear about how you would handle a mortgage rate rise. Of course, at the moment, with the latest lockdowns, the banks are actually giving further interest and principal repayment holidays. But that's just pushing the problem down the track slightly. It's not fundamentally dealing with the repayment question. And what they're doing is rolling up interest into those loans, which essentially means that later on you're going to pay more. And again, the question is, what happens if rates go up? How will you manage it? There's some other interesting data as well. The Westpac MI leading index came out today, and it's showing us considerable fall. Not surprising, perhaps, because of the recent lockdowns, Victoria's 14-day lockdown and the New South Wales lockdown. But the leading indicator is quite sensitive to all of those various factors that are actually in the economy. The full hit, though, has yet to be shown through, is what they say, particularly, of course, with the latest restrictions in New South Wales and now the extended lockdowns in Victoria, and other states also coming on stream with additional measures to try and control the virus. So this is a very concerning sign of more difficulty ahead. And if you want more signs of difficulty, the consumer confidence data from ANZ Roy Morgan this week also was down, fell by 5.2% as the lockdown in Sydney was tightened and another lockdown was imposed in Melbourne. But actually, what's interesting is that confidence dropped the most in Adelaide, down 9.5%, and Perth, down 8.2%, but was also sharply down in Sydney, down 4.8% and Melbourne 3.7%. And this is a very considerably worrying sign, because it means that not only those areas that are directly affected, but the broader indirect effects are now being felt in the economy. And so if you've got on one hand the Reserve Bank and quantitative easing and, you know, trying to throw liquidity on the fire, On the other hand, you've got all of these negative indicators now coming through, which again highlights the uncertainty that I think we're seeing at the moment. And if you want more uncertainty, then the latest retail turnover data from the ABS was also not very strong. It fell 1.8% in June. This is the preliminary series. It'll be adjusted again later. But you can see there, after 3 months of rises, there was a considerable fall. June's fall in turnover was due to the impact of the coronavirus restrictions across multiple states. The ABS said Victoria saw restrictions, then Greater Sydney, and other states and territories saw interrupted trade due to mini lockdowns, as well as reduced mobility between states and the tightening of border restrictions. Victoria is down 3.5%, and that's pretty considerable. New South Wales was down 2% and Queensland down 1.5%, and expect more falls ahead because now, of course, the retail restrictions are even tighter. And it touched all industries except food retailing, which is interesting. And that was perhaps because of all the takeaways. People are trying to get around the rules by offering takeaway services. And also dwelling approvals, they fell as well. The latest data was down. Western Australia down 18%, South Australia down 16.9%, Queensland down 13.8%, Victoria down 5.8%, New South Wales down 4.6%. That's not very helpful too, and it shows again more weakness in the economy. And of course, the building construction sector is currently off in New South Wales. And overall, therefore, dwellings approvals fell 7.1% in May. That followed a decrease of 5.7 in April. This is a structural shift that we're seeing. And just to continue that story about structural shifts, metaphorically and actually, of course, we've got lots of issues with regard to poor quality high-rise construction and more flammable cladding issues. And this headline from a couple of weeks ago highlighted the fact that we've got more buildings being added to Victoria's flammable cladding risk list this year. We have a major issue with lack of high-quality construction in the high-rise sector, both from the point of view of flammable cladding and its replacement, and also more broadly about structural cracks and other defects among multiple properties. And by the way, those defects also run into some of the more newly built low-rise as well, and even houses. We have very poor quality construction because it's being built to a price and it's being built to try and flog cheaply. But this doesn't necessarily stand the test of time. And there's also, very importantly, the psychological harm of what's happening with high housing prices. This is from the Vancouver Sun, highlighting the fact that psychologically, hardworking people who are denied the opportunity to own decent housing have a significant impact on them. It basically is hitting particularly young adults. They feel they're failing because they can't secure their financial foundation, and that gives rise to stress. Many delay a fundamental part of what was historically that which made people happy, starting families. Now, the point I want to make is that this is not just a financial conversation. All of these issues about quantitative easing and where the money is going, and all of the issues about the lockdowns, are creating psychological issues too. Psychological issues turn into social issues. Social issues can turn into societal issues. And unfortunately, my view is that we've lost the plot at the moment because we're looking narrowly at the financial impacts of what's going on, not the broader societal impacts. And I believe that that's something which needs to change, because a lot of what's happening at the moment is to support the short-term financial momentum in the banking sector. I would argue that a lot of the initiatives over the last 18 months or so were frankly bank keeper. You know, first-time buyers being encouraged to go buy a home and land package, despite the fact the price went up by precisely the amount of the stimulus that was offered. And then, of course, the building and construction timeframes have blown out because they can't get the parts, they can't get the bricks, they can't get the wood, and they can't get the builders. Another example of a poorly thought through plan, in my view, just stoked the construction sector. And of course, Gladys Berejiklian closed the construction sites in New South Wales, particularly around Sydney, and there was a huge cry directly from the construction sector saying, you know, we got to keep going, it's so important. Well, maybe, but it just shows that what we have is an economy that's fundamentally driven by construction and mortgage lending rather than actually anything else. And I would argue, as somebody said recently on a post I saw from New Zealand, we have a housing market with a small economy bolted on the side. That's unfortunately what we've got. We've got a very narrowly based economy. Sure, we have the resource sector, which at the moment is doing okay, although ahead the question is, will China go on buying iron ore? But a lot of it is then mortgage lending and the construction sector, and that is pretty much it. We have lost the plot in terms of broader investment in Australia and for Australians, and we have lost the plot in terms of thinking about how we invest for the future. And the consequence of that is that people are spending more of their time and effort trying to get into the housing market, and frankly, the pain that's being caused is extremely concerning. And that's leading also to direct hardship. This is another piece of research that came out quite recently. One in five Australians are still facing financial hardship. This was before the last lockdowns. The latest government support levels are pretty low, not going to help that much. And I don't think that we're out of this yet. We probably will see some sort of JobKeeper Mark II. But, you know, we've got a lot of people who are standing close to the wind at the moment, financially speaking, in cash flow terms. I see it in my surveys all the time. And yet, that's really not a conversation that's had very much. We're always talking about the house price booms and, you know, the resource sector and everything's great. Well, it isn't for everybody. And unfortunately, we do have a lot of people who are under the pump at the moment. And interestingly, one in five households cannot find $2,000 if they need it in an emergency. And that is a concern, driving a lot of people to struggle to get access to credit, which takes them into things like the financial ecosystem, including buy now, pay later, and other short-term credit mechanisms. And unfortunately, this is, to put it mildly, a two-edged sword. This is a big deal. And more broadly, I did a show the other week with the author of a recent report on housing in Australia from City Futures in Sydney. And interestingly, the thesis that they developed, quite rightly, is that we've got a rampaging elephant in the room. It's the housing elephant. Everything is being directed directly and indirectly at trying to support the housing market. And the housing elephant is trampling the rest of the economy, the social norms, the social fabric of the country, and everything else just to maintain the housing elephant. I'll put a link to the full discussion that I had with the author. It's a really powerful discussion. I do recommend that you listen to it. But the point about this is that if you actually align all of your policies, and that's policies from central governments, state governments, the Reserve Bank, APRA and other people, all aligned to housing and trying to just drive the economy through the housing sector, that's what you get. You get an economy that's trampled by the housing elephant. There are things that you could do, but they're not straightforward. And one of the things we have to recognise is that house prices cannot go on going up from where they are at the moment. They will at some point go sideways or even down. Maybe interest rates will trigger it. Maybe the COVID will trigger it. Maybe something else will. But this one-way street where houses appear just to be rising higher and higher is unsustainable. It's only being sustained by more quantitative easing, more liquidity flowing through the system, less good lending standards, and of course attempts to actually take responsible lending laws away as well. This is not a sustainable strategy for a booming economy over the next decade or more. And just to re-emphasize that, we measure mortgage stress in terms of cash flow. This is money in, money out. And, you know, I've had a few people say our method is weird. Well, no, it's not. It's just looking at total money coming into a household. Do they have enough to pay all the bills, including the mortgage? Are they able to save a bit? Or are they having to reach for credit all the time or raise their savings simply to make ends meet? And at the moment, 41.3% of households are in that boat, rising considerably. That's more than 1.5 million households struggling with their mortgage repayments. And interestingly, household debt is down a little bit from a ratio perspective because a lot of people have paid down debt over the last year and 18 months, but it's starting to tick up again. And that means that more people are getting into more debt. And in fact, what's happening is we're seeing people who've had mortgages for some time paying down, but we're also seeing new mortgages from first-time buyers, much bigger, 15% bigger on average than a year ago, and getting ever large mortgages to chase those higher house prices. And I quite often find when I have my conversations with people, they'll say, well, you know, I can see this price moving up faster than my income. The only way I can solve that is to either get a loan from the bank of mum and dad, which I've highlighted as a risk, or indeed just get a bigger loan and hope you can pay it back. Difficult conversation to have when incomes aren't rising and interest rates may rise. So I think that mortgage stress is this high currently, given everything we've got with low interest rates, is of major concern, and yet most people are actually looking the other way. And by the way, some of the other metrics that other people publish on mortgage stress, only looking at the mortgage as a proportion of total income, is missing the point. Because, of course, households have multiple demands on their savings and on their income, and you have to look at it holistically. You have to look at everything that people are being forced to pay at the moment. And at the moment, like it or not, costs of lots of things have gone up. Costs of supermarket shopping has gone up. Fuel prices are still very high, and many other areas too. So just saying, well, because the proportion of income being repaid on the mortgage has gone down a bit from its highs, isn't actually getting to the truth about cash flow amongst many households. So I believe that my method is actually more robust and gives a much better read of what's really going on, and highlights the fact that, you know, more than one third of households are significantly under pressure at the moment from a financial perspective. And in fact, you can look at it in more detail, as I do in my monthly shows. The first Tuesday of each month, we go into it in detail. But just to highlight that we have at the moment, if you look at mortgage stress, 41.33% of households, that translates to 1.5 million households. But we also have a lot of people with rental stress. In fact, rental stress is rising very fast, partly because rents are rising in some areas and partly because people are still under financial pressure. And we've actually got 1.9 million households in rental stress. We've also got property investors struggling as well. More than 830,000 property investors are struggling with returns on their property. They can't let it, or if they can let it, they're not covering the costs of the let, or indeed are trying to sell the property. And overall financial stress, which is an aggregate of all those three, is more than 39% of all households. And that translates to just over 4 million households with some measure of financial stress in their financial footprint at the moment, out of about 9.7, 9.8 million households. That is a big deal. And I want to highlight the fact that we'll be modelling this every month as we do. I do expect these rates to rise further, unfortunately, with the latest lockdowns. And whilst there have been some attempts to try and deal with the issues with government support, those support levels are much lower than they were and will be insufficient to protect people from what I think is going to be a very considerably bumpy ride over the next few months. Now, I will just make a couple of other points. The first is that the listings have dropped considerably. This is from CoreLogic. And in fact, this year, the listings were down and have dropped even further. So we do have this interesting compression where the number of property new listings are down. And yet, if you look at the next dimension, which is, well, what's happened to sales? Well, sales are actually rising. And there's a really interesting conundrum here, because with effectively less properties for sale and more properties sold, you could argue that that will actually drive prices higher. Well, it might in the short term, but overall, I think it's probably not going to continue that long. And I think the lockdowns will probably see to property sales ahead. I know some real estate agents are still trying to get one-on-one shows and trying to get people to go look at their properties. But all the evidence that I'd see suggests that property momentum will ease, certainly through the lockdowns. And then, of course, the question is, what happens as we come into spring? Will more property come on the market or not? And will more people be able to buy? And on that, just one other thing to overlay, something which I keep coming back to because it's so important. The RBA and APRA both have said, house prices are not my problem. This is from Wayne Byers recently giving evidence to the House. And he said, look, it's not our job to solve house prices. It's not our job to solve housing affordability. That's a community issue. In other words, it's somebody else's responsibility. And by the way, the Reserve Bank has also said, no, we think it's not really our job to worry about house prices directly. They are talking about lending standards, and they are saying there's no evidence at this point that lending standards are looser. Well, I would say they're not looking very hard. I've got plenty of evidence in my surveys of people getting bigger mortgages than previously and less affordable mortgages than previously. That's, to my mind, showing that the lending standards, which were loose, of course, as revealed in the Royal Commission, were then tightened and then loosened again. Well, at the moment, they are very loose. Banks, of course, are lending because it's the only game in town. Banks are trying to throw mortgages at anybody with a pulse. And so I believe lending standards are part of the problem. And I have one ordinary, straightforward question. If it isn't the RBA's responsibility, who took rates down to very, very low levels, or APRA's, who are responsible for the question of lending controls within the banks, or ASIC's, who are responsible for responsible lending guidance, or the government, who keeps throwing more stimulus at the market, particularly to first-time buyers and beyond. As well, of course, the states who want more stamp duty, $66 billion of stamp duty yielded in the last 10 years, according to some quick calculations I saw the other day. That's a huge number. So everybody is milking the elephant, if I can put that in one sentence. In other words, nobody wants to address the real question here, which is that we have unsustainably high house prices, we have unsustainably high debt, and unfortunately, there is no simple way out of this. And the more the quantitative easing goes on, the more the interest rates are lowered, the more uncontrollable house prices will be. And yet none of the regulators nor the government want to actually address the elephant in the room, which is the housing market has gone bananas. It's trampling over everything, and it needs to be attended to, and quickly. And with that in mind, I will just touch on our scenarios. Now, our scenarios are ways of thinking about the different futures that might be. We update them every month. We'll be updating within a couple of weeks. But the thing about the scenarios is it gives you a bit of sensitivity analysis as to where things might be going. And by the way, this is a very important message for those who think I only ever forecast falling house prices. Because if you look at my scenarios over the last year or so, I have been predicting that there are scenarios where prices could go up quite strongly, which of course they have been. But I'll also make the point that the average rates of price growth are actually not very accurate at all. I can still point to you to a number of postcodes where prices have down lower than where they were, particularly some high-rise apartments, particularly some houses out in the western suburbs of Sydney or in the high-growth corridors of Melbourne, for example, and even as areas of Perth, which had a bit of a spike, are coming off. Whereas at the top end, standalone houses on large plots, more expensive property, has definitely increased. And that's part of the problem. That, of course, matrix distorts the actual story about property on the ground, which is why I always say you have to go granular and you have to really understand locally what's going on. That said, the scenarios that we look at are trying to give you a flavour of what may be happening ahead. So, for example, in the RBA baseline, in other words, if the RBA is correct and everything goes according to plan, no change in rates, etc., then I think there's still a chance that prices on average could be 15 to 35% higher over the next 2 to 3 years. I give that about a 10% chance. The next scenario is what I call the best case COVID vaccination scenario. That assumes that the vaccine is rolled out. We get everything under control. We open the borders. Then there is the chance of prices going higher, particularly if migration comes back, or small falls. That's a 45% chance. The next one is the longer-term crunch. That's if we get more of these lockdowns. Essentially, the quantitative easing programs continue, but frankly, doesn't necessarily go very far. We might even end up with negative rates, not necessarily at the retail rate or the cash rate, but a rate at the central bank where banks are charged for holding money there. Bearing in mind what I showed you earlier on about the fact that central banks are holding money from the retail banks, it may well be that that's where they go, just like in Europe. But by the way, that didn't have a major effect. Banks still preferred not to lend. 35% rating for that, with a fall in home prices of between 10 and 30%. And then beyond that, if you've got these multi-wave disruptions, so if you get a really major turnout of the virus, then all bets are off, really, and a considerable fall there. And I suppose if everything blew up, maybe had major bank failures, then prices would be considerably lower still. Now, those last two scenarios are only rated 5%, so that's not my core position. At the moment, I'm just hanging on by my fingernails to the best case COVID vaccination scenario. But it wouldn't take much to move into the longer term crunch, which would potentially see prices fall over the next 2 or 3 years. And at very least, I've got the view that we're quite likely to see prices going sideways, if not fall. And certainly the momentum that we saw earlier in the year here is likely to come off, which is another indication of some of the uncertainty that we actually have going on in the market at the moment. And just before I close, I want to highlight the fact that if you want to get more information about what we do and how we do it, you can go to walktheworld.com.au, and there is a launch pad to all of the Walk the World world, as it were. Or you can go directly to my DFA blog, digitalfinanceanalytics.com/blog, and there you can get all of the latest posts and also the latest analysis that I do. And I will just highlight that if you're interested in having a conversation about a particular postcode suburb, then that's something which we can do through our one-on-one service. We have quite a few people who've gone through that process. Essentially, it's an individual conversation with me. It's a confidential conversation with me. I don't give financial advice, but I can use my data to talk about what's going on in a particular suburb and look at the underlying trends. And I can assemble stress data, the home price trend data, and instruct a view as to where price trends might go based on the different scenarios that I've just touched on. And it's possible to book a time for a Zoom or a phone conversation, about an hour at length maximum. And there is a price to it, because it takes about a day for me to do the research, including talking to local agents and pulling all the data together. Pretty powerful conversation. A lot of people have found it very beneficial. And as a result of that, I have quite a few people queued. Typically takes about 3 to 5 weeks to book and come forward. So if you are interested, go to the DFA blog, and there you can see all the details about the DFA one-to-one, which is proving to be quite popular at the moment. And I would make the point that this is probably the best way of getting a feel, not just as a macro level, but on a micro level, down on the ground, whether it's a unit or whether it's a house. What's going on? How many people are buying? How many people want to buy? What is the rate at which property is being settled at? And very importantly, are people settling above or below the asking price? Now, this information is just not available anywhere else, so it's a unique set of data. And if you're interested, then reach for me. So as I come to the end of this conversation, what I want to highlight is that we are in a time of great uncertainty. And in a time of uncertainty, it warrants caution rather than going all out on things. And so I believe that it's time to be cautious about mortgage commitments. Make sure that you run the counterfactual with a rise of 2 or 3%. Can you still make those mortgage repayments? Assuming that interest rates could go up, and assuming that incomes won't go up for the next 2 or 3 years, which I think is probably quite likely. If we get a really significant downturn because of the resurgence of COVID, that's going to have a very strong negative impact on a lot of things, including household confidence and businesses, and that will flow, I think, into the property market. And of course, many people are saying, well, it'll bounce back afterwards, so what's the problem? Yeah, maybe, but the ability to bounce back is being degraded each time we go through this cycle. And I see more and more businesses in my surveys and more households finding it harder and harder to make ends meet, and the cash flows are definitely under pressure. Now, the banks are giving temporary relief. Thank you, banks. But of course, it's in their own interests, because APRA has allowed them to redefine bad loans as not bad loans for the duration once again. So once again, this is an example of bank keeper rather than anything else. And going back to the broader conversation about the everything bubble, stock markets are way too high, driven artificially high by quantitative easing. The crypto markets are all over the place. Don't believe everything you read about cryptos going to the moon. They could, though they could easily well crash. There's nothing underpinning the fundamental value of crypto. And even metals are not necessarily responding well to the current forces. They're not really an inflationary protection, as many people believe. And therefore, you have to stand back and say whether you're looking at property, whether you're looking at stocks and shares, whether you're looking at crypto, whether you're looking at metals, there are no safe havens. They all have potential risks attached to them. And so this is a time for great caution, in my view. It's a time to really understand where you are financially, make sure that you understand your cash flow, make sure you understand what could happen if, for example, you found that work wasn't paying what it currently pays, or if interest rates were to go up. And be cautious about those commitments, particularly mortgage repayments, particularly new properties, because it could well be that things turn rather nasty over the next few months. And if they are nasty, then if you've been a little more conservative with your financial affairs, it's probably going to do you a better service than stretching yourself to the max just to buy that property, which, by the way, this time next year might be higher, but it could also be lower. And finally, to underscore again, this is the real problem with the everything bubble. Nothing is clear, nothing is certain. The only thing that is clear is that central banks are pretty much out of ammo. They'll just go on doing more quantitative easing. The virus is still raging, and we're not sure how this is all going to work. There is no clear exit strategy. There is no clarity ahead. And in these times, given where the markets currently are, I think it's a time for caution. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.